You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Today, I'm going to have a continuation of the segment on the budget deal, and I'll probably, time permitting, also relate it to a number of things, primarily the employment report that we had last week on the 6th of Friday, the 6th of December. I've had really time now to really digest it and try to put it in context. And what's interesting is just the media reaction to that report. I'll get into it, but they said this was a strong report. No, it's not. It's probably the best report they've had in many months, but it's not a strong report. I would say it's not even a good report for the simple reason only 203,000 new jobs, non-farm payroll jobs, were created. Even though the unemployment went down, unemployment rate, the U3, the official headline unemployment rate that the government publishes and publicizes, it's not really a good number. Because, and I'll get into this in a little bit more detail, I would say a good report, not a strong report, not an outstanding report, not an excellent report, would be 300,000 jobs. And the reason why I say that, that's how many jobs you really need to decrease the unemployment rate by just 0.1%. If they had a legitimate increase of 0.3% in the unemployment rate, in other words, from 7.3 to 7%, that's what happened in November, you would need approximately between 500,000 and 600,000 jobs. Why do I say that? Every month, you have people going for their first job. The Department of Labor calls these new entrants into the labor force. And they're primarily teenagers, young people, out of high school or out of college. They could have either graduated from high school or dropped out of high school. In other words, there's 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds looking for their first job, you know, typically at a grocery store or a janitorial job or a stocking shelves or pumping gas, although fewer and fewer of those jobs are available because most pumps today are self-serve. I can remember growing up when if you pulled up at a gas station, someone in a uniform would clean your windshield, check your oil, pump your gas. I haven't had that happen in years. Now, maybe it's the gas stations I go to because I look for the cheapest gas. And in Dallas, that's a company called Racetrack typically has the cheapest gas. But they have competitors. As a matter of fact, right across the street from a racetrack on Greenville is one of their competitors. And they always have the same price because they're getting it from the same refineries. Now, you could go several blocks in either direction and pay more if you want, but most people don't. And most of these outlets are big. They have many, many pumps. They're not your local corner gas station where someone, you know, I would say 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I think the last time I saw this, and I'm really dating myself here, I had moved to Dallas, and there used to be a gas station, the gas station is no longer there, by the way, and I'm trying to think it was on Park Lane and on the side road of 75. It was on the corner, literally the corner, the northeast corner of the North Park Shopping Center. It's no longer there. It's part of a park, I believe today it's part of a parking lot. It might even be part, I'm pretty sure it's now a parking lot. But it was the corner, literally the corner. And the reason I really remember it is that's where I used to. I was new to Dallas. I had moved from Fort Worth. I would go there. And someone would come out and clean my windshield, check the oil. Sir, what type of gas would you like? Regular. And I would pay him. And I would pay him a little bit more because I was in a hurry. That is all gone by the boards. That's what happens. Things change. And that means fewer jobs. That typically was an entry-level job. The people doing those jobs were low-skilled, and they got work experience. You're interacting with a customer. You're doing them a service, cleaning their windshield, checking your oil, which is important. Now, did I really need that done? No, not really. Because, well, let me back up. Now, most cars today, I'm driving a Toyota Corolla, and it's a 2013 Corolla that I'm leasing. I've had it for a little over a year. All I need to do if I want to clean my windshield is sprinkle the windshield fluid on it, and it's clean. I don't need a gas station to do it. That's what happens. You get obsolete. Now, the car I had when I moved over to that was a 73 Buick Regal. And I had that a fairly long time. I've actually had, in my entire working career, three cars. I'm more or less a buy and hold. This is the first time I've really leased a car. And my brother convinced me to do it. And I'm sort of glad I did because it's really not the car I want. I want to buy and hold another car. When I mean hold, maintain it. Do all the maintenance required. I'll probably keep the car 20 years, maybe 25 years. The last car I kept for 23. I should have gotten rid of it many years before, but that's my attitude. Every consumer is different. Every consumer has his preferences. And just an example, my brother's completely different. He's a car guy. He wants the latest car. So he typically leases his car for 3 years. Every 3 years, he has a different vehicle. And he's probably had at least 15 cars, probably close to 20. But that's him. That's not me. Because I'm not a car guy. I don't particularly like driving, although I was in sales and did a lot of driving. That's probably why I don't like to drive. And a car is just, as far as I'm concerned, it's a mode of transportation. Now, I typically have a preference for a mid-sized car. I'm sort of getting off track, but I have a point to make. Over time, people's demand for certain products will change, largely as those products change, and that leads to both employment opportunities as well as people being laid off. Because I don't see, and I'm sure they're still out there, and it's probably the high end. People that go to that are loyal to a brand. They don't care. It's not, I want to say, most people care about the price. But if you're making the big bucks and time is of essence, you go to the one that's most convenient. And if it's 2 cents higher, 5 cents higher, you don't care because you're making the big bucks. It's simply a convenience factor. So anyway, the job at that gas station has gone away. There's still jobs for the mechanics. And there always will be jobs for mechanics because repairs need to be made. But here's another problem. The cars today they're definitely more reliable. They don't typically break down. Parts do wear out. That's why you have to do the maintenance. That doesn't mean there won't be a demand for mechanics. There definitely will be. And many teenagers start, if that's what they want to do. Not everyone needs or should go to college. That's the biggest problem I see today. I'm broadcasting from what I used to call a junior college. Today they call them community colleges. And there's two reasons people go to community college. One is money. It's cheaper to go the first 2 years to a community college. It's the best deal around by far. I didn't go that route. And the reason why is, I don't want to be immodest, is combination of intelligence. I was a very, very good student, national honor roll, have several degrees. I was college material. Because when I graduated from high school, not everybody went to college. Only a small percentage went to college. And I was fortunate to get a scholarship. Between a scholarship, working, and loans, I completed a bachelor's degree, 3 master's degrees, and was a candidate for a PhD in economics. I usually don't get into this, but there's a reason why I'm going to tell you. You have to change with the times. And times are getting really bad for people, especially young people, because they've been sold a bill of goods. And what's the bill of goods they've been sold? Go to college, get your degree, and when you get out, you'll get a good-paying job. That's what my parents told me. I wasn't the first one in my family that went to my immediate family, I was, but in my broad family, there was really only one other person that was an engineer, and I think he worked for the government in D.C., that had gone to college. And believe it or not, at that point in time, and it changed about the time, started to change, a high school diploma was worth something. It was. That's why you didn't need to go to college. Today, that's not the case. Many, many students graduate that can't really read, they can't write, they're not good communicators. And here's the sad part. They think they can go to junior college or community college and get a degree. What did I just say? They have trouble reading? They don't like to read. Why don't they like to read? Because they can't. They're not proficient at it. They're borderline illiterate. In Richland College, as well as all the other colleges in the DCCD, the Dallas County Community College District, has these developmental courses. And I know some of this, I know at least one, but probably know more than one, that teaches developmental writing. I've had conversations with them, telling me I have students that can't tell the difference between a noun and a verb. A noun and a verb. I knew that in elementary school. I definitely knew it at high school. And my point is this. They've had 12 years of education paid by the taxpayers. There's no way in a 16-week developmental course that they're going to learn what they should have learned either in elementary school and at the very latest their freshman year in high school. There's no way you can cram 12 years of education into a 16-week course in developmental writing. You know, he was telling me the story. He would ask his students, okay, tell me which one is the noun and tell me which one is the verb. My mouth literally dropped. And he says, most of them can't do that. What we have here is a failure of education. And it's not at the college level. It is pre-college. Yet the state and the taxpayers are paying for this. And this is across the country. This is not unique to Richland College or the Dallas County Community College District. It is not unique. Because I was telling the story. One way that I paid for my graduate education, and this was at the University of California, Berkeley, I had to borrow money, but I also was what's called a reader. Remember, I'm a graduate student in economics. Readers would grade tests as well as papers, but primarily tests, midterms, your finals, any quizzes. And I would get paid minimum wage, maybe a little higher than minimum wage. I don't know the exact. It was not a lot of money, but it was enough money to pay some of the bills, and that's what I did. Now, most of the courses I was grading the papers for were junior and senior courses. In other words, it could have been, I think the first one was medieval economic history. And that was a big course. That had a big lecture hall. There were probably at least 100 to 200 people. I don't know the exact enrollment, but at least 100 people, maybe 150, and had a big classroom. This was a tenured faculty member, and I would grade the papers. Now, what you need to understand is background. The University of California, Berkeley, is not easy to get into, especially for undergraduates. You need to be an A student. There are some exceptions to that, but you need to be a very good student just to get into that university. And this was many years ago. This isn't today. And I have a point to this story. I'm really doing a detour, but I have a point to this story. I was shocked grading these papers. Yes, there are always going to be A's, B's, and C's. There's going to be a distribution. And some of the students were very, very good. You say that up front. But what shocked me is a majority of the students could not write paragraphs. Many of them couldn't write complete sentences. And you have to do that. Because when I was going to school, there was none of this multiple choice. And that today is a lot of the testing is turned to that. You had to write essays, short essays. And the same thing with the paper. You had to do a research paper. It was none of this A, B, C, D, or true or false. And that's part of the problem. Because what happens is students arrive in college and can't write. Some of them can't read. A lot of them can't read. And some of them that can read don't even read the assignments. And they can't write. Let me tell you something. If you want a good paying job, you have to be able to communicate. And that means face to face and in writing, and you have to read, and you have to be a good listener. Communication skills are critical. Because I'll tell you this, if you have good communication skills, you can find a job anywhere. And one area is sales. There always will be jobs for salesmen. I was one of them. There are always jobs for salesmen. But you have to communicate. That is a critical skill. And you have to present your ideas. And you have to answer questions that you don't know in advance what the questions will be. Let me back up. Yes, you do if you're prepared. And if you know your product inside and out or a service or whatever you're selling, most if not all of the questions you should be able not only to answer but have a very good answer. But what the taxpayers of America are doing are really subsidizing babysitters. At where? Junior colleges or community colleges. It sounds better to say a community college. What's interesting, they still call the four-year college a senior college. No more do you hear junior college. My problem is I'm sitting at a university, and I've been in these courses, and I've had a representative sample. Some of the people there are very serious. They're serious about doing their homework, getting the assignments in on time, doing the best they can. But there's a significant minority, and I would say upwards of a third or even half of the students, simply are not capable of doing college-level work. They're wasting their time, they're wasting taxpayer money, and they're wasting the professor's time. They shouldn't be here. They should be out looking for a job. And that's increasingly tough for teenagers. The teenage unemployment under Obama every month has been over 20%. That's high. Teenage unemployments are always in the teens. But for this president, for his entire 5 years, it's above 20%. And if you're a minority, it's much higher than that. I've heard reports in the 40s to 50%. So finding a job today is not easy. And I'm going to relate it to the budget deal, and I'm going to relate this to the unemployment report, or some people call it the jobs report or the employment survey that came out when the studio or college was closed because of the freeze. The point of this story is the U.S. taxpayers, people that are working, that are productive, pay taxes. And they pay taxes for schools, both elementary and high school, and they pay taxes for people who go to college. students on this campus are subsidized, big time. That's why it's cheap. And the tuition has gone up quite a bit, and still people are coming. The problem is it's open enrollment. Anyone can show up and be enrolled. But invariably what happens, I've seen it, I've talked to instructors, they more or less confirm what I'm saying. A significant minority, significant percentage, a third to a half, college is not for them. They are literally not capable of doing the work. And even the few that are capable don't apply themselves. They don't do the reading, they don't do the assignments, and then they're expecting a C. And unfortunately, a lot of them get Cs. They're passed along. That's one of the problems. People are just passed along. Maybe they'll finally get the message. And it's sad, because they think they're doing well and they're not. And there's no way you can make up in one course, whether it's developmental math or developmental writing. And I know some people that had to go through this. I know a lady, for example, that her goal was to become a professional photographer and to get a bachelor's degree, and I believe she passed or finished her master's degree. The problem was she was not good in math, and she wasn't really a good student in high school. She came back and had to work really hard and repeated many of those developmental math courses. She's the exception. She's really the exception. But she worked hard. She applied herself. The rule is most of those people that enter, whether it's developmental math or developmental English or writing, never make it through. There's one excellent book, I forget the title and the author, but someone really was confirming what I already knew, but he was confirming it, was teaching these courses. And it's not just developmental writing. It is also just basic freshman English. And I think why I'm getting on this, I already have more degrees than I need. But I'm trying, I'm very close to finishing up an associate's degree in mass communication. I don't need the associate degree. I'll have one soon. But I did it for one simple reason. I'm looking to be on... My goal, career goal right now, is become a nationally syndicated talk show host that can carry a three-hour show. You notice we've had no call-ins. We've had no call-ins. We're not equipped for it. We don't have an audience for it. And I wish we did. It would make what I'm doing more interesting, more challenging, but we don't. And I'm not pushing for that. I actually was asked my first year doing this, would you like to have that, Ray? And I said, there's not enough audience. You won't get enough people to call. Because we're not over the airwaves. Some of these colleges, the senior colleges, universities, the four-year colleges, and I went to one of them, have radio stations that are actually broadcasting. Richland College is broadcasting, but it's broadcasting over the web. We're web radio. And most of the people that listen to this show are listening it over the web. They're really listening to the show as a podcast, because what I'm doing right now is recording the show. After it's over, I will edit it and then post it on my companion blog for this show, which is prompopops.wordpress.com. And that's where you go if you want to listen to the show, because at the very top, I have links to the most recent shows. And below that, I will have a complete archive of all my shows. But that's where people go to click on the link to take them to Podomatic and listen to the podcast for this show. This show, I believe, is the 180th show. So I'm somewhat departing from the usual format, because this is very much a news-driven show. But I'm trying to give you some background and relate what's happening on campus to the job situation and the budget. And I have less than an hour to do that. So I better get right on track. So I'm completing this associate degree. And the only reason I'm getting it, I know I'm going to have a job in it. And they're going to say, well, Mr. Pronk, you obviously have a great education. You have a number of professional certifications, a lot of great job experience. But do you have any education in broadcasting? And I'm going to smile and say, yes, I do, sir. You're right, I have a bachelor's degree, but I went back to get an associate's degree in mass communications. I don't need another associate's degree, but I wanted to learn what I needed to know to be an outstanding broadcaster. And also, right now, for example, if I had that interview day, I've done 180 shows. And you can listen to any of them. Now, why? I'm not bragging here. I'm trying to make a point. When whatever field that you're interested in, that you're trying to make a career, or get simply a job to pay the bills, you're going to have this interview. And you're going to have to convince the person that you can hit, when they hire you, you can start. No more training. They assume you know how to do the job. And you better be able to do the job. You can't fake it anymore. And what I'm trying to do is a long shot. I know this. This is a very competitive field. And very few people can carry a three-hour talk show. Because most, even the best ones out there, rely on calls. I listen to most of the major, the stars in talk radio. Even amongst them, there are only a few that literally could carry the show. And what I mean by that, no call-ins, no interviews. Now, I would like call-ins, and I really like interviews, but we're simply not set up for it here. And I've done several interviews here, and I like it because I think I know how to do interviews. You know, one of the biggest problem, and I've seen it with some of the people that are big names, very successful on the radio and on television, but one of the problems they have is they keep interrupting. They're compelled to interrupt the speaker. My approach to interview is very simple. First, you prepare. You'd like to know what the guy's going to talk about, and I prepare his questions. Sometimes I don't have the opportunity to do that. I have to wing it. I don't like to do that. So I have some prepared questions. But I listen to the person I'm interviewing, and based on what he says, ask, it's sort of a natural curiosity. I said, well, if I want to know this, I'm sure other people that are listening want to know this. And that's not easy to do. You need to keep the conversation flowing and going, and whoever you're interviewing is going to expect you to carry your end of the conversation. Because I've interviewed several people very much spur of the moment. And what I mean by that, I would find out that someone was giving a prepared lecture or a presentation. I would go to it. If he was interesting, I'd introduce myself after the speech and say, if you have a few minutes, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, however long you have, would you like to be interviewed by the radio station KDUX? We have a student radio show. We'd love to have you on it. And I say, most of them will say fine, and I've done that, spur of the moment. Usually I prepare, but I've done a few like that. And you have to be, you got to have communication skills. Because I know if I had a syndicated show, you might get a call. Would you like to interview Senator so-and-so, Congressman so-and-so, an author of a book? Yes, I would. Book them. See, I don't have a producer. That's not an excuse, but most shows have producers that we'll arrange that. Now, I'm more proactive. I would say I'd like this person on the show, but we can't do that. It'd be very difficult to get them on. It just would eat up into my time. What I'm trying to illustrate here, any job has a set of skills. And if you want a job, you need those. And if you've wasted your high school years not learning the basics, like how to write a sentence, how to write a paragraph, how to write an essay, you're going to have a hard time. And those 12 years are gone. And I just finished under a lot of distress. I didn't want to take this course. But I was down to a few, literally three courses short of this associate degree. I've taken all the communication courses. And like I said, I already have a bachelor's. I have two associates. And I was really annoyed that they're insisting, well, you have to take freshman English too. I don't want to belabor you with, and what I would tell them is, excuse me, I've had English in college, and I also took two literature courses where basically we had to write about books, poems, whatever the assignment was. I know how to write. I know how to commute. No, you got to take English too. Or get us a description of those courses, and there's no way I can get a description of a course that I took many, many years ago. I tried, but no way. So I bit the bullet and took the course and just finished it and aced it. I had to write essays. For me, that's fun. For most students, it's torture. I like to write. I like to talk. I like to do research. So I wrote the final essay. And if you're in freshman English, no matter what school, you got to write an argumentative essay. Well, there were some books that I wanted to read, and I wrote one. And I'm very proud what I did, but this was somewhat, for me, child's play. It was an interesting exercise. But I know for some of those students, because they split us up into groups, and I had to read, and this was a little bit different from when I was a freshman in college. I was reading other students' papers. Now, remember, I said earlier, when I was at Berkeley as a grad student, I used to grade papers, so this didn't surprise me. I was reading student papers. Now, with one or two exceptions, I'm sure a lot of students dropped out. In my group, at least one or maybe two did. I'm not sure of that. But there were a few of the students, because initially we weren't in groups, and you would have to randomly pick some of the students and read their material, and it was obvious to me some of these students were having trouble with their grammar, with their spelling, writing sentences and paragraphs and a coherent essay. And what's sad about it, it's rather late in the game to find that you don't have those skills. What were you doing for the 12 years you were in elementary, junior high, and high school? There's no developmental course you can take that's going to get you there. I've talked to instructors. I've read books on this. It's a joke, folks. It's a waste of taxpayer money. Yes, there are people that go through those courses. Some of them, English is a second language, so they're perfectly capable. If they're, let's say they speak Spanish, they can write, speak Spanish, but their problem is writing and the grammar in English. You're always going to find those people. They don't have a problem if they truly can write another language. It's really a second language problem. It's not really a communications problem. They can express themselves in other languages, the English. But with setting those aside for a minute, it is sad. Because here's the problem. If you can't truly write, you're going to have a problem in not all courses, but most of your college courses. And if you ever get to graduate school, the same thing. Because there are certain minimum requirements, general requirements. And what I'm leading up to is this. College is not for everybody, despite all the propaganda you hear in the news. Most people, frankly, should not go to college. They could pursue careers, and they're doing it. Now it's out of necessity. Because people that are well-educated are taking jobs, not necessarily pumping gas, because there's not many jobs today pumping gas. There are a few. I'm sure in Dallas there are a few gas stations that still have someone that'll come out and clean your windshield and pump gas and check your oil. Not the gas stations I go to. Most gas stations today are self-service. There are a few that are not, and they always charge more. So it's not a big career field or how should I say this? I wouldn't expect to spend a lifetime pumping gas. You have limited opportunities. Now here's the problem. Put yourself in the place of a young person, a teenager, either out of high school or going to college, needs a job, and you're in the job market situation. And the unemployment rate amongst teenagers, in round numbers today, is 20%. 20%. And if you're a minority, it's higher. You're going to have a hard time finding a job. And there's also a bigger problem. More and more college graduates, people that have gone through the program, and I'm not talking just at the associate level, I mean a four-year degree, can't find jobs. And one of the problems is there are many, many, many applicants for every job. And they're up against competition. People that have years of experience. many of them doing the exact job they're applying for. That's the environment we're in. So you need to do your homework. You need to work hard. You need a strong work ethic. If you don't have a strong work ethic, you're in trouble. And I feel for these people. Because how can you make up 12 years of a high school? And many of them, it's 16 years. Because people are being passed through. I never had that problem. But good friends of mine have. They're just not good students. It's not that they don't want to work hard. Many of them are hard workers. I work with many people that don't have college degrees that not only have been successful, more successful than I, but you need to learn that. And my advice to any young person, if you can, start your own business. And if you can't do that, then go look around, knock on doors, call up, whatever, new businesses that are starting. Because that's where the jobs are. It's not the government. The jobs today are created by small and medium-sized new businesses. That's where you go to get a job. Now, I was listening to a talk show. It was the Rush Limbaugh show. I was running late, and I decided I've been running late today. You ever have those days? You get behind, and you're behind all day. Well, that was my day, including this radio show. And I don't normally bring this up, but there was a caller that, and it was one of the calls you want. It was an excellent call. It was someone from Brooklyn, New York, that started his own business. Went to college, but started his own business. And is successful at it. Works hard, but close to half of the money he earns is taken from him by the government. Local, state, and federal. And he's going nuts. And it's a small business. I think he said he had 8 employees. And he's finding out his health insurance is jumping up quite a bit. I think it's more than double. So he's not happy with Obamacare. But here's the problem. Here's his predicament. He has to pay what he was saying is for his full-time employees. He has to pay at least half of their health insurance. He's willing to do this. But here's his problem. Because of all the taxes and the increase of the insurance, he is going to have to lay off some of these people. And he says a year ago he was thinking about expanding his business. This is a typical small businessman working hard. Let me tell you something. Most of my clients were small businesses, and I was a small business owner. You work 24 hours, 7. Now, I know I sleep and all that, but what I'm trying to say, when you're a business owner, you work, you're always thinking, what can I do to do better? How can I grow this business? How can I be more successful? And you want to expand. You want to grow. And you need to hire people. And you need to retain good people. How do I do that? How do I do that? When the government is taking half, he said he had figured it out because he's in New York City. So he's paying income tax in New York City, state, and federal. And he's making money. It's not that he's not successful. He's making money. But in the end of the day, he's paying 48% of everything he's earned goes to the government as taxes. And then he's hit with Obamacare. And as a result, instead of expanding his business, hiring new people, he has to lay off people because he has to provide health insurance for those employers. Because he's on the plan. And he says if they take it, some of them will, some of them won't. I used to sell it. That's the situation because sometimes an employee has coverage through their spouse and declines it. And he's not in a position to pay 100%. You can pay 50%, you're going to have to pay the other 50%. And that's not unheard of either. It really depends on the cash flow, the success of the business. But here is a typical small business owner being hit every which way with taxes. This is not an environment that encourages people to do this. And what's the problem with that? I did a calculation, and this is why I'm relating it to the unemployment numbers. And I was a little bit off on the numbers yesterday, and I need to make a correction. I don't make that many mistakes, but I made a mistake yesterday. And one of the reasons is I hadn't had time to really go down and dig deep on the unemployment report, both the household survey and the establishment survey. So I was off on the numbers. And let me kind of refresh your memory and make the correction. The highest level of employment that the United States has had in its history, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, was in November of 2007. November of 2007. And after the show today, I'll edit it and post it. It'll probably be up this evening. But in November of 2007, and that was the peak of the previous boom, was 146.6 million people. American, 146.6 million people were employed. That was 6 years ago. 6 years ago, we reached a peak of employment. As of December 6th, that reported the numbers for November, the total employment in the United States today, and I'll round it up, is 144.4. We are still after 6 years behind, just to equal the previous peak, 2.4 million jobs. I said it was three. I was a little bit off, because there was a big jump in November. And I need to say this. The October numbers and November numbers are, there's a lot of noise there because of the shutdown in the government. And all those people got paid. They went back and got paid. They got paid for sitting at home. So I have no sympathy for them. It was a waste of taxpayers' money. That's why I'm not really big on shutdowns, other than permanent shutdowns of entire departments. And I'll be getting into that in a minute. So just to get back to the previous peak, and that was 6 years ago, we'd have to create 2.4 million. Is that how many jobs were short? No. Because that was 72 months ago. 6 years is 72 months. Now, what happened every month, what happened? You had population growth, but you had new entrances, new people going for their first job, high school and college, graduates as well as dropouts were looking for their first job. Now, how many? That depends on the economist you go to. There's a range of estimates. The Department of Labor, when they questioned the commissioner in charge of it, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, said on many occasions somewhere between 130,000 and 140,000 jobs you need just to keep up with population growth, namely new entrants into the labor market. That's every month. That's just not 1 month. That's every month. You're on a treadmill. And that's just to keep even. Now, some economists are lower than that. Some are higher. And if you ask them what the difference is, a lot of the times it's what are they assuming in terms of the labor participation rate. And I'll get into that in a minute. Right now it's at 63% is the labor participation rate. That has changed over the decades. For example, in the late 1940s, 1950s, the labor participation rate was below 60%. It was around 57, 58%. These numbers start in 1948. Now, what happened over the decades is, especially starting in the 60s, the 70s, and continuing today, more and more and more women entered the labor force. There have always been women in the labor force, but what typically happened, women would get married, they would stay at home and take care of the children. And then when the children went to school, they might have a part-time job. And when they were out of school, then the women would return to the job market and work full-time. Now, more and more people, more and more households, both the man and the woman, the husband and the wife, are working. Why? Taxes. They want to do right by their children. And they might spend several years caring for them. But many people are career women today. So what happened over time was the labor participation rate went up, up, and up. Now, when George Bush was president for 8 years, from 2001 to 2009, it was typically in the range of 66 to 67%. Some months it's over 67%. I want to get you, so you get an idea of what's normal here. Now, what typically happens when you go into a recession, people are laid off, and as a result, are either they get discouraged or not in the labor force, can't find a job. So the labor participation rate has been going down. It's at 63%. It actually was lower than that and slightly improved this month, which is good news. That's what you want. Because you need to get back to where the labor participation rate is somewhere between 66 and 67%. Now, I'm telling you this because my estimate, you need about 150,000 jobs a month because I assume a 66% participation rate. And if you really push me, I would say it's probably 155,000 if you're going to assume a 67% rate. But that, like all economists, they all have different opinions. This is a range of estimates. It's not a precise number. In many respects, it's a guess, looking at past history. Some of them might have models following this. But the point is, it's a range. Now, I'm telling you this for a reason. Whether you multiply 72 months by 130,000 or 72 months by 150,000, those are the new entrants to the labor force during those last 6 years. That is somewhere between 9 and 10 million jobs. And then when you add the 2.4 that were short, and I think that's going to bounce back closer to 3 because I think we got a lot of noise in those November numbers because people were returning to work that were temporarily laid off. They were furloughed and they were called back after about, what was it, about 2 weeks, and they got back pay and now they're working. What you really, like I said last show, you got to really wait to the March reports to really see, because all these numbers are revised. Now the problem is this: the economic policies of this administration, President Obama and the Democratic Party, have not worked. They've not created the job. My estimate, they're short somewhere between 11 million to 13 million jobs. That's to get back to the previous peak as well as employ the people that entered the labor force. And if you look at what the, I always need to say this, and I'm somewhat remiss. We have the unemployment, the official unemployment numbers, the so-called U3 number. And I have this, I have all the numbers, and let me scroll down. That's what I'm doing right now. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment level today in the United States, this is the U3 number, is 10,907,000. Now keep in mind, that's an estimate. They do these household surveys to come up with these numbers. And the survey is approximately 60,000 households. And that fluctuates. I'm not going to get into details. But that's the best, that's the so-called headline number. Really, ladies and gentlemen, and that's why I have at the very top, I show you, and this the firm that does this is Shadow Statistics. Now, they will show you the U3 number. That's the red line. They'll have what's called the U6 number, which I'll give you in a minute. And they have this blue line. And I'm going to ballpark it because I don't have the exact number. And you've got to pay some money to get their exact number. But their unemployment rate is about 23%. Not 7%, 23%. Now, why? That used to be the government's number. Not the number, but the blue line. What happened is Bill Clinton, when he was president, had the Department of Labor change this. They used to have 7 unemployment numbers, U1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And U7 included what's called the long-term discouraged worker. In other words, workers, you're discouraged if you're ready and willing to get a job, but you haven't looked. In other words, initially you would apply for jobs, you'd send resumes, and you would do this for months and months and months, can't find the job, and you, you basically drop out. So he said, let's eliminate those discouraged workers that have dropped out for more than a year. Now, you can make a case, and they obviously did, let's not publish this number. That's the more meaningful number. There's a world of difference between 7% and 23%. A world of difference. That's more than three times, in round numbers, the number of employed, if you believe the Bureau of Labor Statistics, U3 numbers, and some people have been questioning that, and that's another show. We have approximately 11 million people unemployed. The old U7 numbers, you can multiply that by more than three. That's over 30 million. It's probably over 33 million. And then if you look at the U6 number, and that's still published by the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, it actually went, there was some improvement in that number, and I got to scroll down to get it. Hang on a minute, and I'll have it for you. Okay, the U3 number, the official unemployment rate is 7%. That's a strong report, according to some comments. The U6 number that you seldom hear about, except by professionals that know what they're talking about and really have looked into it. That number, and this is the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics number, not my number, not this other organization, it's 13.2%. I bet you that's several million more people are unemployed. You better believe several more million people are unemployed. Now, what does that number include? It includes the short-term discouraged work. You see, when they do this household survey, they ask you a question. Have you looked for a job in the last 4 weeks? And if you answer that no, guess what? You no longer are unemployed. You're a discouraged worker. You're a marginally attached discouraged worker. In other words, you don't count. Well, what they do with the U6 number is count the short-term discouraged. Now, if you've answered, they'll ask you another question. Well, when was the last time you looked for a job? And if you say, oh, a year and a half ago, bingo, you don't count at all. You don't even count in this U6 number. It's only if you haven't looked in the last 4 weeks. And that happens because what happens, many people, especially if you're in a small city or town, you sent your resumes out, you're applied, and you're not getting any. You're not getting interviews. If you're getting interviews, you're not getting hired. You can't find a job. And eventually people, it's only human nature, become discouraged. They give up for a period of time. And then what happens? They try again. What you don't want to do is join the long-term discouraged, because then they don't even count you at all. They used to. They used to have a U7 number that included that. That's the number I gave you. You can't get it anymore, but what this outfit does is include those people. That's why their number is much higher. You see, the government is into public relations. They're spinning it. I call it lying and misleading you. Because all the news comment, that was a strong report we had. Well, I will say it's probably the best report you've had in 2-3 years. But it wasn't a strong report. It wasn't even a good report. Why? Because only 203,000 jobs were created. That's the government's number, the non-farm payroll number. And what did I say? You need 300,000 jobs just to really legitimately decrease the unemployment rate by 0.1%. This was 0.3 of it. To do that, you would have, I'm going to use my 150,000 number just to keep it simple. You need 150,000 jobs for the new entrants. That's just to keep even. Then you need another additional 150,000 jobs to reduce the unemployment rate by 0.1%. So if you're going to reduce the unemployment rate by 0.3%, and I'll do the numbers, you need to add 150,000 for the new entrants, and then multiply 150,000 by 3, that's 450,000. You add the two numbers together, it's 600,000 jobs. That would, in my opinion, be a excellent report. 600,000 jobs were created in November. And then I would believe the 0.3% drop. Now, what was the number that you heard? 203,000. Yeah, it kept up with population, whether you believe it's 130,000 or 150,000. So it's not a bad number. It's actually a fairly respectable in this sense. It's better than last year. They're running somewhere between 190,000 and 200,000. It's closer to the 90,000 for this year. So they are keeping up with population growth, but they're not making a big dent in the unemployment, because you need about 150,000, and depending on, let's keep it simple, you need at least 150,000 when you've already, when you first, you got to take care of the new entrants, and on top of that, and 150,000 to 170,000 jobs to reduce it by a tenth. That's why my rule of thumb, and it's not just mine, a lot of people have this rule of thumb, you need 300,000 jobs, non-farm payroll jobs, to be created to reduce the unemployment rate by a tenth of a percent. Now, that will change over time. It's been lower, and in the future will be higher, but that's what you need. So, and if you're going to do it 0.3%, you need about 600,000 jobs. Remember, these are estimates, ballpark figures. That would have been an outstanding jobs report. But what would you need to produce that kind of job? You would need economic growth in the real gross domestic product, which is the total of final goods and services produced by the entire economy, of somewhere between 4 and 5%. Now, over the last year, the U.S. economy, it fluctuates by quarter. It's running around 2%. Some months it's below, some months it's higher. We're below the historical trend rate of about 3%, 3.1%. The way I like to say it, we're running about two-thirds speed, somewhere between two-thirds and half speed in terms of economic growth. Now, why this is important, you need to be growing at somewhere between 3 and 4%. Many economists would say you need to be growing about 3.5%. to get the 300,000 jobs. We're not growing at that rate, despite the number, the spike up in the number. They've had a spike number, I think it was 3.8, and I think I did that several shows ago. But most of that was inventory. You see, these numbers are going to bounce around. They'll be revised, and they're estimates. We're not growing at 3.8. Most economists would say, maybe 2%, plus or minus a couple of tenths of a percent. That's why this was not a strong report. I beg to differ for some of these newscasters and commentators, and I watched several. Oh, this is a strong report. It's a great report. It's a good report. No, it's not. It's a good report if you compare all the other months. I will agree with you there. But you're not even producing enough jobs to legitimately decrease the unemployment rate by a tenth of a percent. Not even close. And you got a lot of noise in those numbers because it included the people that were furloughed coming back. I'm very interested in the December, January, and February unemployment, because that distortion in the numbers will be out of there. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because I think you got a lot of noise going on. And I'm not talking about, you know, there's been accusations that these numbers are being manipulated. I'm not making that charge. Whenever you do a sample or a survey as a sample to do an estimate for the entire population, you're going to get a large range. And occasionally you're going to get something that will be corrected. So I'm not saying the Department of Labor is cheating, although, and it's not the Department of Labor, the Census Bureau, the Department of Labor hires the Census Bureau to hire people to go out and do these surveys. And there have been reports that some of the people that are doing these surveys are playing games with the numbers. They're not legitimately doing the work they were hired for. They're guessing. They're filling in the blanks. And that's a problem. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Department of Labor, and the Census Bureau better make real sure that they're not doing that. Because if they get caught doing that, the credibility of all these numbers goes out the window. I tell people, don't trust government statistics. At best, they're estimates. At best, they're estimates. And I hope they're not politically changing these numbers. A lot of people are suspicious. I am suspicious. But that's speculation on my part. The bottom line, what I'm trying to say is, don't fall for this nonsense that they're repeating this message. This is the lowest unemployment number in 5 years. Factually, that's true. But what they're missing, what they're truly missing and not stating, people are not participating in the labor force. our labor force is actually shrinking. And what's going to happen at some point, the economy is truly going to recover. We're going to have a boom. And what's going to happen? And this is what you want to happen. People that are not participating, are not counted, are going to come rushing back into the job force. And you'll see that in a rising labor participation number. So instead of being at 63%, it'll go to 66% and probably 67% or higher. If we were really in a boom economy, the participation rate will be above 67%, and the unemployment rate would definitely be below 4%. And if it were really a true boom, it'd be under 3%. And we've had under 3% unemployment rates. That would be a outstanding report. And I wish it were true for everybody. It gives me no pleasure to do an analysis where I see millions of people of all ages being hurt. You know, time is money, and if you're not working, not only are you not earning an income, but that's lost. It's lost forever. It's not 11 million people. It's over 25 million. There's over 25 million people. And really, I think the number is way over 30 million that really want a permanent full-time job. And a larger and larger percent of those people are young people that are just starting out in their life and can't find the job. That's why I go over these reports every month. It can be dry, but it does have an impact. And it's a concern. You've heard the stories. Children, they're not children. We're talking adults, are living with their parents. Some with their grandparents, but many with their parents, because they can't find jobs. They don't have money to have an apartment and pay an electric bill or even have a car. That's millions of our young people. That's why I get very, very irate and somewhat passionate, but irate about this budget deal. It's a joke, folks. There are several things that are causing this high unemployment rate. Remember, for every day President Obama has been in office, the unemployment rate has been above 7%. And we were told by his advisors, if they pass this stimulus package, today it should be about 5%. Not 7%, 5%. And that's many millions of more people working. That's why we have these massive deficits, because we have tens of millions of people that are not working. They're only not paying payroll taxes, they're not paying personal income taxes. See, the answer to today's problem is everyone that wants to work can work at a good paying full-time job. We're not even close. And one of the major reasons are the economic policies coming out of Washington, D.C. And both parties are guilty of it. Because what have they been doing for the last, really, 12 years? They've been spending way beyond the means of the American people to support this government. That's why out of every dollar that the government spends today, approximately 35% has to be borrowed. In other words, when we run these massive deficits, remember in 2009, 10, 11, 12, the deficits were over $1 trillion. $1 trillion is a thousand billion. And what's a billion? A billion is a thousand million. We're talking huge money here. Huge. Even Bill Gates' net worth is at best, the last time I looked, somewhere between 50 and 60 billion. This is a whole order of magnitude different. The federal government is for the 9, 10, 11, and 12 fiscal years ran deficits where the outlays, government spending outlays, were over $1 trillion, over a thousand billion. Then they brought in from all taxes together, all what they call revenues. I consider that to be immoral, because you have to borrow the money. And that puts an additional burden on not only the living today, but future generations. That's why spending is out of hand. And before I was preparing this show, and someone had an interview with the CNN guy, had an interview with Nancy Pelosi. And what the Democratic Party are pushing right now is they want an extension of long-term unemployment benefits. I'm against that. I totally oppose that. And she, I don't know how she ever got Speaker of the House, but she was saying the moral thing to do is to extend these benefits. And this is the same woman that's calling people like me, Tea Party, conservatives, immoral. We're racist. We're extremists. The Democratic Party and President Obama are responsible for these massive deficits. Not all of them, because the Republicans are not much better. Believe me, they're not much better. And I'm not a Democrat or a Republican, because my philosophy is classical liberalism, which is limited government. And she got on that. She said the problem with these Tea Party folks is they want to eliminate government. Ms. Pelosi, no, we don't want to eliminate government. I'm not an anarchist. See, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to demonize people like me, whether we're libertarian, classical liberal, or conservative. I'm not against government. I just want limited government. I believe in a constitutional republic. And the problem is government is way too big. Listen, when you have to borrow every year, year in, year out, billions of dollars to pay your bills, who's the extremist here? Who's immoral? Lady, it's you. It's Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats and Republicans. Because let me bring this back to the so-called budget deal that I was talking about on the last show. And I focused in on the fact that they made a big deal. We're going to cut the deficit by $23 million. That's a joke, folks. They spend that. And here's the joke. It's over 10 years. And it's backloaded. It really occurs towards the end of the 10 year. But I'm not going to backload. Let's just simply divide it by 10. They're going to cut the deficit by $2.3 billion. No, they're not. Not in this fiscal year. But let's pretend they are. How many days do you think, in terms of deficits, that's going to cut? It's probably less than 12 hours. Because the federal government is somewhere, the deficit is going to fluctuate day to day, month to month. But we're running somewhere between $3 and $4 billion of deficit every day. Because I gave you the numbers, and you could look it up. Go to pronkpops.wordpress.com and go to the notes for my 179th show. At the very top, I have the monthly Treasury statement that comes from the Department of the Treasury that will show you at a very top level what have been the tax revenues collected in October and November, what have been the government spending or what they call outlays for October and November, and then if you subtract the two, you get the deficit. And the deficit, I don't have the screen up, but the deficit for the first 2 months, ballpark figure, is $235 billion, just the first 2 months. That's slightly less than $120 million. I'm going to do some rounding. Let's say it's an average of $110 billion a month. That's over $3 billion every day that they're overspending. They don't have the money for it. They don't have that, and that means they have to borrow it. And that was what I was focusing in on. But then John Boehner, the current Speaker of the House, really, I have lost all respect for the guy. I hope they primary him, get him out of the leadership. I'm done with him. He supposedly was a conservative. Not where I come from, because I've been in the conservative movement since Goldwater, and one of the key principles of any conservative, whether you're a traditionalist, a national defense conservative, or an economic or libertarian conservative, one of the key principles is fiscal responsibility. And that means balanced budgets. Balanced budgets. Not in 10 years, every year. And that is the problem. Neither party is capable of that. Spending, whether it's entitlement spending, welfare spending, defense spending, spending in general for the federal government is out of control. What both parties have been doing for the last 80 years is playing Santa Claus. We'll give you this goodie if you vote for me. Well, the chickens have come back to roost. A day of reckoning is coming. And the immorality of both political parties and the politicians of both parties to keep kicking the can down and running the debt up, up, and up, burdening all living generations and future generations, that's immoral. That is the scandal. They are the extremists. They are the nuts that are running the asylum and spending your money, and many of them getting rich in the process. It's disgusting. And who are they hurting? They're hurting their own children and your children and your grandchildren and future generations. And the media goes along with this. They don't do their homework. All the information I've been telling you today, you can get online. Yeah, you're going to have to do some homework. You're going to have to figure out, what does this mean? You're going to have to connect the dots. The problem is no one is connecting the dots. You know, I have at least another hour of this show, and I'll continue it tomorrow. Because the lady in charge of the department say, Ray, I'd like to get out of here by 6, and I'm already over. But I'll give you a little teaser what I'm going to bring it back to. Because I was, like I said, I've been listening to a lot of talk radio. And talk radio is dominated mostly by conservatives. Many of them, I won't say all of them, but many of them are Republicans. There are a few libertarians left. And many of the libertarians have given up, like me, on both parties. But I think, and here's the problem. And some of these are the leading talk radio. They're staunch Republicans. They're staunch conservatives. Some of them are libertarians. Well, we need to elect the right Republican conservative libertarians, and that's going to solve it. No, it's not. What did the Republicans do when they controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency? They ran up the deficits. Yes, not as much as Barack Obama and the Democrats, but they did the same thing. They had control of all the government. That's why blame is on both parties. That's why I'm not a Republican anymore. I finally said to myself, listen, we've elected one president in my lifetime that I can say was a conservative, and really I think a libertarian, and he had his faults, and that was Ronald Reagan, but only one. And most of the nominees of the Republican Party are at best moderates. Many of them are progressive. They're just big. I have a term called the bigs. Who are the bigs? The bigs are the big interventionist government statists. What do the bigs want? They want big government. And that's the Democrats and the Republicans. That's why I've given up on the Republican Party. And the problem is many of these talk show hosts, not all of them, many of them are lawyers that have worked in, for example, the Ronald Reagan administration. And one of the first things they say, well, don't talk to me about a third party. We just have to elect good conservative libertarian Republicans. Don't waste our time. Yet I've heard both some major talk show hosts bemoan the fact, well, you know, let's say we elect a conservative Republican as president. They're going to have a problem, and they will have a problem. What happens is many of these political appointees are turned into civil servants. In other words, they become part of the bureaucracy. Oh, that is a problem. When most of your advisors in most of your departments, a large percentage of them, are bigs. They believe in big interventionist government. That's why they work in the government. They want a government job. They love a government job. And what do bureaucracies do? They want bigger budgets and more people, a bigger empire. How many Republicans have you heard say, we need to close 8 to 10 departments? Yes, Ron Paul has said it, and I supported Ron Paul, but I knew he didn't have a chance. He didn't have a prayer. Better him than anyone else. The problem, ladies and gentlemen, when you're in the situation we're in today, that's only part of the problem. You literally have to close, permanently 8 to 10 departments. Do any of the politicians up there propose that? You know, occasionally they'll talk about, well, we needed to close the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, and they might have one more. Governor Perry in the debates, you know what happened. He forgot what he was going to close. See, I would have said, no, I'm going to keep open the Treasury Department, the Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, Department of State, and that's it. In other words, by Department of Agriculture, by Department of Commerce, by Department of Labor, by Department of Energy, goodbye, Department of Interior. You see the problem, even I forget all of them. Transportation. Now, immediately, you know what the reaction is? You can't do that. You can't do that. You see, what we have in Washington, D.C. is a big bureaucracy that is promoting big government. We don't need this big government. And the problem is we can't afford it. When you're at the point that for every dollar you spend, you have to borrow 35 cents out of the dollar, and it got up to about 40 cents, you're in trouble. And we are in trouble. And that means I'm not talking belt tightening. I'm talking the government needs to go on a fast. Now, why am I a little bit hot under the collar? Do you know, Boehner says, well, if you're for deficit cutting, you need to support this bill. Sir, you're lying. You've been, unfortunately, listening to too many Democrats, because that $23 billion is nonsense. It's trivial. And here's what I didn't cover and I need to cover, and then I'll need to shut down the show. What they're really going to do is spend an additional $65 billion over the next 2 years. $45 billion in this fiscal year and $20 billion in the following. And it will be split down the middle, half of it going for defense and the other going for a lack of a better word, social spending. In other words, the part going defense is to placate some of the conservative Republicans in the House and the Senate, and for the Democrats, they get their increase. They're increasing government spending by $65 billion over 2 years, $45 billion this fiscal year. That's the problem. You're being misled, you're being lied to. I'm totally against this budget deal, and so are a lot of senators, and so are a lot of people in the House. And they are largely conservatives, and they're largely libertarians, and they're largely Tea Party men that haven't forgotten the fact that one of the key principles is fiscal responsibility, or another way to say that, living within your means, balancing the budget. We're not close to that. We had a deficit of last year of $680 billion, which was actually an improvement over the last 4 years when they were over $1 trillion. We would have the number is zero deficit if we actually had a balanced budget. And you see what the Republicans have been doing year after year after year, just like the Democrats, but year after year after year, they're saying, well, in 10 years, we're going to have a balanced budget. In 10 years, we're going to have a balanced budget. And Ryan, the salesman, has a rather thankless job, but I've lost respect for him. You see, what should happen, we have in place the Budget Control Act of 2011 that sequestered, that made cuts. And the Democrats don't like it, and neither do the Republicans. But guess what? That's the only thing that has resulted in cuts in spending. That's why we have only a $680 billion deficit. I think that's a disgrace. But what is the Republican? They want to cut a deal that'll add $65 billion. Now, that's not a lot, but I don't want to add one penny. We should be cutting hundreds of billions of dollars. The problem is we have dysfunctional, divided government. That is the problem. And my concern is that even if the Republicans maintain or increase their control of the House and get a majority, and maybe even 60 senators in the Senate and get control of the Senate in 2014, and then in 2016 elect a Republican, my greatest fear is it'll be business as usual. In other words, the budget will never be balanced. Yeah, they won't spend as much as the Democratic Party, but they'll do the status quo. They will continue the status quo, and we will have deficit after deficits of hundreds of billions of dollars. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been lied to. We have been misled. We have been played by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. a plague on both parts, because what they're hurting is the young, the future generation, who can't find jobs. Or that businessman from Brooklyn, where nearly half of everything he earns. And most small businesses, they report, they do their taxes as an individual. Half of it is. That's not an incentive. That's not encouraging business formation. And that is where the wealth, the income, and the jobs of America come from. It is those small and medium-sized businesses that expand into giants. You know, whether it's a Hewlett Packard or a Microsoft or a Google, just to name three, they all started small. Or a McDonald's or Walmart. We need tens of thousands, if not millions, hundreds of thousands of small businesses like that. Because a few will be really successful. That's how you get the unemployment rate to near full unemployment. In other words, below 3%. That's how you get a booming, prosperous economy. I'm for a peace and prosperity economy. And that means radical downsizing of the federal government. We can no longer support the size and the scope of the federal government we have. What we're doing is profoundly short-sighted, profoundly immoral. It's simply wrong. It's wrong. And people are waking up. The young are waking up. They don't like to live with their parents. They want to start a career, a family, or a business. And what are they faced with? An economic environment that's truly hostile to business formation. A tax code that's ridiculous, that no one understands. Now, that'll be a subject of a separate show, but I'm for a consumption tax. I call it my fair tax less plan, and I'll get into it in future shows, where when you go buy a good, no more federal income taxes of all types. We'll do away with all federal taxes and replace it with a federal consumption tax. And then when you buy a good or service, you'll pay that tax. That's the totally separate show in and of itself, and I've done that in the past. But the central problem today is government spending. It's beyond being out of control. This is dangerous. Because what have you seen in the last 5 years? More and more people on disability, more and more people on food stamps or SNAP, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Programs, more people on welfare, more and more people that want to work can't find a job. It's not as bad as the Great Depression in the 30s, but if we don't watch out, even with all the programs that are out there, there's a problem. We can't afford them anymore, and that just doesn't seem to sink in. This is, there's a debt time bomb that's going to blow up, and when it blows up, what's going to happen? Interest rates are going to skyrocket, and interest that the government has to pay will go up, up, and up, and it'll squeeze out all these programs, all these agencies. We simply won't have the money, and we won't be able to borrow it. Or if we borrow it, it's not going to be at near zero rate. So you got to connect the unemployment situation with the budget situation, and they have consequences. I am totally against this budget. It's not that an additional $65 billion over 2 years is a big number. Not when you're spending over $3.5 trillion, but it's going in the wrong way. And the only reason they want to do, both parties want to do this, they don't want another government shutdown. I don't want a government shutdown. I want a downsizing of it, but I don't want a government shutdown. I just want to shut down about 10 departments permanently. Not this temporary furlough nonsense where they come back and get upwards of 2 weeks of back pay for sitting home and watching television. That's a joke. So I don't want a shutdown. At least get their butts into work and do whatever they do. But what really needs to happen is a downsizing, a radical downsizing of the federal government. And that's what the Tea Party is about. We want balanced budgets. We don't want bailouts of companies. And many of us want departments to be shut down. And that's just part of the problem. There's no magic silver bullet. You definitely need fundamental tax reform. You need fundamental reforms of entitlement program. You need fundamental reforms of welfare programs. And that's why the fiscal conservatives in the Republican Party, the true fiscal conservatives, most of them, and I've been checking on them, are against this deal. And it'll probably pass. You know why? The Democrats are going to have the votes. And you're going to have a number of Republicans, both in the House and in the Senate, that will go along with it, including the leadership. Take down names, because everyone who votes for this deal, and it includes Ryan, it includes Boehner, should be primary. The Tea Party should go after these people. They are not true conservatives. We have a sequester in place by law, the Budget Control Act of 2011. Let it stand. Don't touch it. It's the only thing that's been responsible for these reductions in spending. And yes, Barack Obama proposed it, and it got passed, and they've woken up to the fact it was a big mistake on their part. But we have our leadership of the Republican, not my leadership, but of the Republican Party that wants to undo this. Are they out of their minds? Do they ever learn? The joke is the Republican Party is the stupid party. And guess what? I'm tending to believe with them. That's why I'm for a third party. The leading talk radio show, you know the name. Oh, we can't have that. Excuse me, what are you getting with the Republican Party? You see, the dirty secret is, not all, but a large percentage of the Republican Party, especially the leadership, they're bigs. They're big interventionist government statists. They like to talk the talk of conservatives, some even libertarians. But when push comes to shove, what are they doing? They're doing these stupid budget deals, going in the wrong way. And don't give me this nonsense of regular order. Yeah, the United States government should have had a budget every year. I agree with that. Just like every individual, family, church, business, city, county, state has a budget, and they balance it. I'm all for that. Had we had one in the last one, you had to go back to Clinton, and only the reason, and I'm not giving credit to Clinton, is because at least we had some Republicans that tried to balance it. And there were some games being played. But my point is, if you think the Republican Party and the leadership, the establishment, is going to change, you're sadly mistaken. They're for this. It's just a little bit less. In other words, there's not a dime difference between the two parties. That's why we need a party, another party. Call it the Independent Party, whatever, the name's not important. You know, I'm a big supporter, for example, of Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee in the Senate, and there's some in the House as well. The problem is they're too few in number. That's why both the Democratic Party leadership as well as the Republican Party leadership tries to demonize us, demonize them, trash them. Because they don't want fundamental change. They want business as usual. All they're about is getting reelected. They are career professional politicians that will say anything, do anything, as long as they can get reelected. I'm not a Republican, but I'd be embarrassed what the leadership of both the House and Senate are doing. And I fully expect this budget deal to be passed, largely by Democrats, but a significant number of Republicans. Why? Guess what? I'm not stupid. You have defense contracts that make contributions to House and Senate members, and a good chunk of that $45 billion, not all of it, about half of it, and another $10 million in 2014. That's just starters. That's where that money's going to. They don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about, ooh, that $23 billion cut in the deficit over 10 years, most of it towards the end. Give me a break, Mr. Boehner. You're lying and misrepresenting and misleading the American. Shame on you. That's why I've given up on him. He's just a guy with a fancy suit and a nice haircut and a nice tie. He's not very good at talking. And he wanted to say, oh, they don't even understand the deal. Well, I'd like to understand more of it, but it's hard to get all the information. The information I have tells me this deal stinks. It's, and if you're concerned, and let me say this, and I'll need to wrap up the show. If the professional career politicians are concerned that they don't want to shut down, do what they've been doing for the last 3 years. And I don't favor it, but this is the out. This is better than this deal. Just pass another continuing resolution. That's what you've been doing. That's all you got to do. Don't touch the sequester, because you already got those cuts in place. That's what the Democrats want to bust up, and that's what this deal does. And Ryan says, it keeps 70%. Mr. Ryan, I want you to keep 100%. And I know your leadership doesn't want to do that, because they have corporations in their districts and states that want that defense spending or want that welfare spending. I'm not stupid. You think the American people are stupid? We're not falling for this routine of kicking the can down. And that's what all this is. That's why I'm totally get rid of that 10-year baseline. That is part of the problem. And that's why my recommendation, you budget to last year's collected revenues, period. Not a cent more or a cent less. Not a cent more. You know, last year in round numbers, they collected $2.7 trillion. That should be the maximum cap in spending for fiscal year 2014. Do you think that's what they're going to spend in 2014? No. It's going to be about $3.6 trillion. In other words, we're going to have probably ballpark another big deficit of probably $800 billion. I could be high, could be low. Is that an improvement? It's not an improvement. That's why you need to keep the Budget Control Act 2011 Act in place. You see, they're gutting that. They're already gutting that agreement. And that's the only thing that has been responsible for these cuts in government spending. And why should you be concerned? Do you have a son and daughter that can't find a job? Can you find a job? Do you have a friend that can't find a job? A relative who can't find a job? Would you like to start a business, but you can't because of this economic environment, because of Obamacare, because of rising taxes? You see, we need tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of new businesses to start. And some of those will become giants, but not in this economic environment. Not with a government that's out of control. Not with government spending that's out of control. Not with debt that's out of control. You have to connect the dots. You got to pay attention, because it's affecting you, me, your loved ones, your friends. It's affecting all Americans. Some of you are fortunate that have a good job, have job security. By my estimate, over 30 million Americans, and that's probably a low number, can't find jobs or can't find permanent. That's a scandal. That's a scandal. Because at the height of the Great Depression, and this is an estimate, but 13 million Americans, we're several times that today. I know the population is bigger, but that's the size of the problem. That's why you see the rise in food stamps, the rise in welfare recipients, the rise in subsidized housing. So I hate to give you this bad news, but what I'm trying to get across is you got to connect the dots. First of all, you got to pay attention, you got to wake up, and you got to do your homework, and don't fall for the lie that both political parties are telling you. This is not a good budget. It's not terrible, but we have something in place that's better. No deal. Sometimes, and I've been in this situation, I used to be a negotiator of contracts, so I know a lot about negotiating. But sometimes, if it's a bad deal, you walk away. There's no compromise. And that's where we're at. I'm a little bit surprised. I really should not say this. I knew they were going to try something like this, and they did. And they thought they could spin it, and they probably will get away with it. As I'm speaking, supposedly they're having a vote on the Senate, in the House, and then subsequently on the Senate. But they're having a vote on the House. I would not be surprised after I end this program, look at the TV, and find out they've passed this budget. And who are the losers? You, me, your children, your friends, your relatives. The American people. That's who's losing. And they'll try to spin it. Both parties will try to spin it. And the only reason they're really doing it, besides the additional spend, is so that they can take off the table
that there won't be a government shutdown.
And you can argue that that's not a bad thing to do, because then you can focus on repeal of Obamacare. And I see that argument. But it's ignoring the two things, well, really the one major that's driving these economic problems or the consequences, namely high unemployment, and that is out-of-control government spending, both mandatory and discretionary. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening. I hope to have a two-hour show tomorrow, but I'm really going to have to be strict about it. It'll probably go to 3 to 5. I was a little bit fortunate. I had expected by now that the lady in charge of the department would have shut me down. Apparently, she's still grading papers, so I went a little bit, well, I went about 40 minutes longer than I anticipated going, but I'm glad I had the opportunity to do it. Now back to the news.